beautiful hum. The first reading this morning is from the late Howard Zinn, a man whose take on history and whose support of Martin Luther King and whose call to withdraw from Vietnam was considered so controversial by the United States government that he was labeled a high security risk and thus subject to immediate arrest should the USA enter into a state of emergency. This is from his 2006 book, A Power Governments Cannot Suppress.
To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of present moments. And to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory.
The second reading this morning also comes from an outspoken and controversial author, Arundhati Roy. Her novel, The God of Small Things, won accolades around the world. But she does not confine her activism to writing. She is also visionary and quite political, filled with fiery hope and strong critiques of worldwide government-sponsored oppression.
Our strategy should be not only to confront empire, but to lay siege to it, to deprive it of oxygen, to shame it, to mock it with our art, our music, our literature, our stubbornness, our joy, our brilliance, our sheer relentlessness, and our ability to tell our own stories. Stories that are different from the ones we're being brainwashed to believe. The corporate revolution will collapse if we refuse to buy what they are selling, their ideas, their version of history, their wars, their weapons, their notion of inevitability. Remember this, we be many and they be few. They need us more than we need them. Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing.
Thank you.
He was setting me up for my sermon. So, as of today, December 7th, 2014, if my studied estimate is correct, I will have completed by the end of this particular sermon 1,568 sermons in the course of my ministry. Many of my younger colleagues, because they know of my longevity and the length of my experience, reach out to me these days to ask me questions about how I approach my sermons on Sunday. More specifically, they ask, what does it mean to preach Sunday after Sunday after Sunday for about 37 years, almost 40 years, if you look at my internship? What do you preach about after a decade, they ask me? After 2 decades, haven't you run out of things to say? Well, I usually say to them, I used to wonder that, too, when I was a freshly minted minister. I used to say to myself in August, oh my God, I have 40 sermons to give this year. How am I going to do that? How is anyone going to do that? And I used to live in a state of panic. But I did get through my first year, and I did get through my second year, and the next 35 years, only rarely repeating a sermon in some other place, and even then, never exactly by any means. But let me be clear. I always tell my colleagues, my younger colleagues, as time has gone on, I found that the world will almost dictate your themes to you, even if, like me, you begin the year with a list of monthly themes in a 3-year cycle, like I've done for quite a while here. I promise you, I really promise you that on any given week, the world, of which we're all a part, is going to offer you a war, a famine, a shooting, a choking, a disaster of some sort, or some unbelievable injustice. And that very same world is going to offer you reports of a remarkably kind act, an astonishing self-sacrifice, a beautiful late autumn day, a truce, a declaration of rights, or an astonishing work of art, be it painting or music or film or dance. Just pay attention to what's going on around you. Wrestle with it publicly and find a way to give people some hope. That's all you have to do. But most importantly, I always conclude, just live your life. Cook your supper, wash the dishes, take a walk with a friend, hold hands with your spouse, marvel at the wisdom of children, or just grab a cup of coffee in the morning down at your local cafe. I tell you, your sermons will write themselves. At least that is how it works for me after all these decades. So by now, having heard me just say, just go grab a cup of coffee in the morning down at the local cafe, some of you are certainly expecting that I'm going to mention a conversation I had at my coffee house. One-line coffee house on High Street in the Short North. And you'll be right, of course, because I've based quite a few of my sermons this fall on conversations at that cafe. So Friday before last, I was sitting there drinking a rich Costa Rican brew and beginning to fret about what approach I might take this morning as I lead off the series on hope. Hope, after all, is not only a vast topic, it is a vague topic. I wasn't sure what I even meant back in August when I wrote my sermon title down on the schedule. It's a long time ago now. And then this regular guy who I see all the time there named Drew comes and says hi to me. And we end up having a conversation, and he tells me he's entering a dance contest on the following night. I said to him, what kind of a dance contest? It's a contest, really? For dance? Come and see if you're free, said Drew. It'll be fun. Come around 7 p.m. The event will go to midnight. Well, I wasn't sure I could make it. I already had some plans, I seemed to think, in my schedule. But at the last moment, my plans were canceled because my friend got the cold that seems to be going around quite a lot these days. So I went. The event was held very close to here at the studio above the Half Price Books down or up at Graceland. I paid my $10, went through the entrance room, and then entered a back room without any windows, I seem to remember. In this room were two 10 by 20 square foot dance floors, rectangles, one made of wood and one made of a substance I could not identify. The wood floor served as the contest floor with five seats along one of the long ends of the rectangle for the judges. The other one was just for practice, just plain fun, it turned out. People simply danced all night on that second one for joy, even if the contest was going on. The whole room, I have to admit, was pretty small. There were no chairs. Everyone, both contestants and audience, just stood. I didn't understand some of the jargon being used, most of it actually. I didn't understand the exact rules of the contest. What I saw was dancers in pairs standing opposite each other on the narrow ends of the wooden rectangle. One by one, the music, very much like what Nathan played earlier before the sermon, music not chosen by them, but just given to them, was played, and they entered the floor space one at a time, alternately, and then they danced. What kind of dance? Good question. Breakdancing is what comes to mind first, but I'm telling you, it was a lot more than that. I saw dance steps, so fluid, so completely fluid, that Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers would have been green with envy. I saw leaps using gymnastic strength and balance and spontaneous, very quick steps of such creativity and surprise, I could barely believe that they were improvising these dances. Some of you may know that breakdancing was developed originally as a way of competing or addressing conflicts without violence. So everyone was dancing there with grins on their faces at each other, dancing at each other, and sometimes they'd finish their thing and go, bring it on. But let me now tell you what else I saw. I saw 8-year-old boys and girls dancing, competing with the adults. I saw men and women in their teens and 20s and 30s and even 40s dancing. I saw women and children and men competing with and against each other with great big smiles on their faces the entire 4 hours I was there, and hugging each other and walking around after their contest with their arms around each other's shoulders, no matter who had won, according to the judges. congratulating each other. I saw people on the other dance floor receiving audience, wow, oh, you go. Constant congratulation, constant blessing. I also saw people who were slender, slender as straws. And I saw people who were as heavy set as a bag of cement. I saw very tall dancers, and I saw dancers much closer to the ground. I saw people in every shape, and I saw people of every ethnicity and color you can imagine and maybe can't imagine, in perfect demographic representation of the world, if not your own particular picture of Columbus. Or to use the usual words, I saw people with clear roots in Asia, both East and Southeast and South, in Latin America, both Central and South, in the Middle East, especially Iran, in Europe, in Africa, in Polynesia, and wondrous mixtures of every one of these origins, forging beautiful features and skin colors never before seen on the human in the human palette. I saw all of this. The contest went on for hours, and I was both amazed and happy throughout the entire experience. But I began to realize half an hour into it that I was beginning to feel something inside of me that I could not put my hands on, could not name in any easy way. It began to bother me. But suddenly, in a flash, it occurred to me what I was experiencing. I was feeling the actual experience of living in hope. I was in a state of hope. I was submerged in hope, baptized into a pool of hope, aflame with hope, alive with hope. Not hope as some highfalutin cardinal virtue or comforting theological expression about what is going to come, but hope glowing in my flesh in the present moment. I saw the world to come as I had always best imagined it, but not as something to come, but as already here. Not at some utopian day in the future. In the Gospel of Thomas, there is an interesting dialogue between the teacher Jesus and his students. They ask their teacher, when is the realm of God, or the era of love and justice for all would be another good translation. When is the realm of God finally going to arrive? And Jesus answers, well, it's already there, spread across the whole earth. You're just not seeing it. I know I usually don't see it. That's because I'm either concentrating on all the negatives or because in the past I've used the word hope as a simple substitute for the word wish. I hope everything goes well during your surgery. I hope you get your wallet back. I hope your son returns home in time to get you to the airport on time. Simple wishing for good for others. Fine. Nothing wrong with that. But it's really just a common courtesy, that's all. It's not very powerful. Just kind of civilized, I guess. But what I experienced Saturday was not a common courtesy, but something much stronger. Something powerful, something joyful, something transcendent, and more profound and more deep than the world of shootings and chokings and war I mentioned at the beginning. Like Howard Zinn, I have always pointed out in my sermons that beside the horrible events which throw themselves at us every single day, we are also every single day joyfully ambushed by good things. Actions of love and compassion, stories of remarkable forgiveness and community support, kind of like the amazing story told by Patricia Boughton this morning. What kind of support she finds here that's miraculous. My sermons over these last 37 years, as I see them, have been sincere attempts to respond to both of these realities, the shockingly painful and the astonishingly beautiful. In Howard Zinn's great words, "To be hopeful in bad times is not foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion and sacrifice and courage and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we only see the worst, it destroys our capacity to do anything. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world off in a different direction. And if we do act in some small way, we don't have to wait around for some utopian future. The future," he says, "is an infinite succession of present moments, and to live now as we think human beings best ought to live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a remarkable victory." Exactly. At the dance contest above half-price books, I witnessed a victory. Not of one dance team over another. I witnessed a victory for humanity. Present today, now, not later. I was there. I testify to it. Arundhati Roy says the same thing with even greater power, almost an aggressive power. Our strategy should be not only to confront empire, but to lay siege to it, to deprive it of oxygen. Not a weak metaphor there. With our art, our music, our literature, our stubbornness, our joy, our brilliance, our sheer relentlessness, and our ability to tell our own stories. Stories are different than the ones we've been brainwashed to believe. The corporate revolution will collapse if we refuse to buy what they are selling, namely their version of history, their notion of inevitability. The notion of inevitability is the precise opposite of the word hope. It's the antonym. Like both the political and religious leaders on the difficult side of the island you heard in the story this morning, inevitability establishes their version of history. It's not going to work. You're going to hurt yourself. You're going to hurt me. Can't be done. Actually, no one else ever really did it. You're mistaken. You were told the wrong story. Hey, this is the way it's always been. Don't rock the boat. Get used to it. But I testify, at the dance studio last Saturday night, I was in the midst of the positive, not the negative, in the room of many colors and many styles, with a great deal of joy and welcome. I was seeing with my own eyes the realm of love and justice for all, the realm of God in the words of the Gospel of Thomas. Already, right now spread across the earth. It was not some hope for what's to come, but it was hope embodied, present, already here. I touched it. And so when you preach about hope, I tell my younger colleagues, just live your life. Let yourself be open to what's right there in front of you. And I promise you, the sermon you want to give will simply jump up onto the pulpit and deliver itself. At best, in all of your career, you're only going to be the servant of the sermon that comes to you as a gift because you choose to live your life. And you will live in gratitude all the rest of your days.